My name is Nancy DeLette, and I'm speaking with Rose Kravitz. Today is Tuesday, August 6, 1985. We are going to begin this interview at 11:20 a.m. We are going to interview Mrs. Kravitz about her immigration experience from Poland in the year 1920. This is the beginning of side A of tape one of interview number 013. Can you tell me where and when you were born?
I was born on an estate. My grandfather rented it. He didn't own it. Jews were not allowed to own. So he rented it and he ran it. And it must have been thousands and thousands of acres. Such a large estate.
Where was the estate?
In Poland.
In Poland.
Yeah.
And
he was raising beets for sugar, hay for the army. It was a very large business. They had 500 cows, 100 horses, and the milk was going for butter and cheese. They had a centrifuge, a machine that worked it. So that's where I was born.
And I'm sorry, this was your grandfather who ran
My
this?
Grandfather. And my grandfather had 8 children. And they were all on the same place. Even those that were married and that had children stayed on the estate. And this was going on. Peasants were working the fields. And the servants were for the house. It was a rich house. And all this, 1 year that I don't remember what year it was, I think maybe 1910, there was a hurricane. Just when everything was ready to take off from the fields and destroyed everything that was on the estate. That was a time where my grandfather sent about 5 children, they were grown-ups, families, to America. This is how my father landed here too. And my father served in the Russian army. It was not a Polish army, it was a Russian army, 5 years. And that was the whole, most of the family was here.
What year were you born?
I was born in 1902.
So do you remember that hurricane? Do you remember that disastrous hurricane?
Yes.
You were about 8 years old then.
That's right. Yeah. And something else happened at that time when I was 8 years old. The owner of the estate lived in Warsaw. And he came and he brought his wife to the estate. And she didn't want to go back to Warsaw. She came with her family and stayed in the estate. They took away that house, the beautiful house where I was born there. And they built another house for my grandfather. So they were 4 children that they had. And they were 2 little girls that were my age, 1 9 and 1 8. And we were playing together there. And then one day, the kids, those 2 girls, came over to me and they called me Reja. And they said, "We cannot play with you anymore because you're Jewish." So that was my encounter with anti-Semitism. The mother didn't want them to play with me. And so from then on, all the grown children went to America.
And your grandfather sent 5 children to America at that point?
1 daughter and 4 sons. And they moved my mother and the children to a city. Not anymore in the state, but my father came here. So they moved to a city. So we were living in the city for just a while. Then the war broke out. So my grandfather sent two peasants with wagons to take our family back to the estate. And that's where we stayed until Jews were not allowed when the war broke out. So for a while they let my grandfather, because he's a big, his name was all over in that area, knowing. So the police had this association with him, and they let him stay with the family for the longest time. Then they let other Jews that lived in villages. But then at the end, they told him that he must leave. So he left all that, the cows, the horse, everything. And the commandant arranged a train for my grandfather with the family. And the house, my grandmother made the servants dig holes, and all her goodies got in there and covered up. And everything was left, the milk, everything, no matter, to the servants. And we left the house. And we started traveling with a train to Brest-Litovsk. The Germans were going after the Russians. So Brest-Litovsk, they were held back. So after we left Brest-Litovsk, they found a little, was not a village, a town, a small town, where we settled there. And then we stayed there for a while because the Russians pushed back the Germans. But then the Germans came back and they started going forward. So we had to leave that town. And so
who were you with then?
My mother.
Mother?
My sister, my brother. Oh, yeah. While this thing was, yeah, that was the other, yeah. When we came to Pinsk, when the Germans took over, so we stopped. We were supposed to go to Kajerinoslav, and the Germans came, and they took over. So when the Germans came, so my grandfather died in Pinsk. And my mother also became sick. But she survived that horrible sickness. There's a little incident I want to tell you about. The doctor that came to see my grandfather and saw my mother. So my grandfather died very soon. But my mother was very ill. And she was a beautiful woman. And she was lying on a bed. And as I remember her at that time, the doctor sends from the Jewish shul, Jews with beards, to massage her. And she was half naked. Are you acquainted with Rubin's figures? She just looked like that. And four Jews came, and they massaged her. This was the doctor's order. And as she lay there, the naked body, and the Jews with the beards were massaging her. When they got tired, the other two Jews took over. And when these four got tired, other four Jews came. And they kept it out day and night. But she got out of it. She became well. Then we started training back where we came from. Not to the city, but to a village where an uncle of mine lived there. So we walked all from Pinsk. So it must have been thousands of miles we walked. And we came to that area where we stood, where we started living there. And that all the peasants in that area, they were frightened about the Germans. So they went to deep to Russia, the peasants. So they left their villages. They left everything that they had. They only took with them the horses and the cows. And on the way, they couldn't keep them. So they used to leave them. The government took over the horses and the cows. And the peasants were afraid to come back because they didn't like the Germans. So we were there. So the potatoes were almost frozen. So my grandmother, my aunts, my brother, and I, we all dug the potatoes because this was the only food that was there. And so we put them in the, we dug things, you know, places, and put the potatoes in and covered them with straw so they can stay over the winter. And this was supposed to be the food for the whole family. My aunt that was there, she did not realize what she was doing. The Germans came to her. The Germans took all the food from the whole area where they occupied Poland and sent it to Germany. They came to her that she had the potatoes that we dug. And she sold the potatoes for a sugar. They gave her sugar. The sugar we couldn't eat. So the whole family was starving all the time. There was no food at all. And that's what she did. So she didn't care about my grandmother that dug it, all of us that dug it. She just got, she felt that she has a right to do it, and she did it. And nobody could stop her. So it was a terrible, terrible time that we went through.
How long a period of time were you without food?
Oh, this was after the the war started in 1914. I think we stayed there for about a year, and then we were on the way to Pinsk. And going back from Pinsk, that took also maybe 6 months walking. And when we came there, we started digging this potatoes. And that's how we lived. When I think about what happened, how did we survive? I don't know, because there was no food at all. Just hunger all the time. I remember a tree, there was an apple. But when the apple started forming, that I tried, and I boiled it. And it was impossible to eat that, because there was nothing else. And it was very hard to stay with my uncle. So my mother went to the city where we came from after my father left. And she had long hair, almost to the floor. And hair was very valuable. And she thought that if she'll go to the city, she'll sell it. And so she walked away about 12 miles, and maybe longer than 12, much longer. And nobody wanted to buy it, so she couldn't sell it. But she stayed on there because her father, my grandfather, lived there. So she stayed with him while he was sick. And we kids, at that time we were four, because one brother died there. All the four kids stayed with that uncle, with that aunt that sold the potatoes. And she came over, when I stood there in one of the rooms, and she said, she took a knife, and she said to my uncle, "I'm going to kill myself like this if you don't throw them out."
Meaning you?
Yeah, me.
The children.
And he said, "Yentele, yentele, you're Jewish. Don't do it. Don't do it," you know. And I stood there and I listened. Look, compose myself. Then my mother took a peasant hut and we moved into that place. And I beautified it. I did everything to make it nice. So the Germans were in that village and they came and they wanted to know who's doing this beautifying. And my mother told them that I did it. So that was one thing. Then they came and they wanted me to take me to Brest-Litovsk and to work on ammunition. So this uncle of mine tipped them or whatever he did, so they didn't take me. So this is, yeah. And now I want to tell you a little story also what happened there. When my mother went away to have her hair sold, we already moved into that little house. Next to that little house was a woman that had her brother, the Germans took him. He was a youngster, I don't know, 14, 16. And they took him to Brest-Litovsk to work on ammunition, which he did. And when he came back, he had ammunition in his pockets, all kinds of things. And he had nobody of his size to show off. So my brother was a little boy, 5 years old, and like other kids. So he took the ammunition. And he was showing it off that when you strike it, it makes fire. Her was also a peasant's hut that was straw. The top was made of straw. So when he was doing this, it got in. And there was a fire, and it burned off 12 houses, and our house too. But before that happened, this woman had a garden, and she had beans that you'd wind around on sticks. So she wanted that my brother, he was that time, I think, 12, that he should do it. So he did it. So she gave him a pot of sour milk. But we figured it out that just to eat sour milk wouldn't do anything for us. We were four kids. And so my grandfather was known by the peasants. When I mentioned the book, that was the water that he had to cross. And a German and Austrian soldiers were on the bridge standing guard. And they didn't let anybody cross over. So my brother knew of a spot where he can cross over. You know, so they didn't see him, but he used to go down and cross the river, not through the bridge, go to the peasants. And for my grandfather, they all knew, they used to work for my grandfather. They used to give him a piece of bread. So he knew that if he'll go and he'll get a piece of bread, he'll bring back the bread, so we'll have the sour milk for the bread, which was the biggest occasion. So my brother was 5 years old, the little one. He was a hungry child. He saw that pot with the sour milk. He went in about 15 times, and he ate some of it. When my brother came back with a piece of bread, I made a table, we put out the dishes, and I took that pot with the sour milk, supposed to be, and I left it on the table, and everybody was supposed to have it. And a slice, my brother sliced the bread, and everybody got a slice of that bread. And when I took the pot to get the sour milk, there was nothing there. And my brother, the kid, was sitting there like nothing happened. He didn't admit that he did it. This is happening. Anyway, this was one of these things that you take it in stride, you know. Yeah. Then the time when that house got burned up, there was an office in that area, in the village, where the officials lived in it. And they, what they did, that they officiated over the people that lived, the peasants that lived there, you know, some of the Jews. So my mother took one of the rooms in that house and put in whatever she was able to get. A bed, everything, you know, and fixed it up. We stayed there, I don't remember, maybe 3 months or 4 months. The Polacks, the Germans left that time, and the Poles took over. When they came in, officials, a commandant, and all this, they looked around back, and they wouldn't go into a peasant. There were a lot of peasants' houses. They saw that house, and they came into our room, and it was looked nice. My mother had somebody build a stove to be able to cook. And Gigi, get out. Gigi was Jews, get out. So my mother had to get out. And there was a dark room in that place. So my mother got that dark room. In that same period, I don't remember, but Hoover sent the food.
President Hoover from here sent food.
Right. So he sent it to a city. And whoever had to go to get the food, there was a group, a few people that had a horse and wagon. They went to the city. Before they went to the city, they took all the people that lived in that area. A lot of Jews came to the villages because they had no food. And they thought in the village they'll dig something and they'll find something. So they took the names. Like my mother had four children, so they took her name and her four children. And so the others, and they went away with that list, and they gave it to authorities in the village, in the city. And with the wagon that they had, they gave him a lot of things. They gave him flour, cereals, all kinds, evaporated milk, a lot of things. They kept it for themselves and gave very little to the people. A token of that food. And then they decided that even that is too much. So they arranged a woman that she should cook a soup. And all these people that needed the food, they should go with a little pot for the soup. So my mother organized all the people and said, it wouldn't do any good for you with that little bit of soup. We went back the little that they gave us, and not the soup. So nobody went, and they had to throw out the soup. They didn't serve. So this was one of the things. Then there was something else. The very same people arranged with the city, whoever was in charge, that all the orchards, they were ripe that time, that all the orchards belongs to them. Nobody from outside would there go in and pick an apple or a pear. So they put my brother, he was a kid, I think he was 13 or 14, that he should watch and do it, that nobody should do it. And for that, they gave him some of that food. We already lived in that dark room where the Poles took over. And my brother became ill. He ate something, maybe some of the fruit that was not right, and he became very ill. So this uncle of mine went to bring a doctor. and the city was 20 miles. He went for a doctor, and he brought a doctor, and the doctor realized that my brother's dying, that he couldn't do anything. But the formality was that he has medicine. So my uncle had to bring him back. So I don't know what my uncle had in mind, but he said to me, "Rose, you come with me." And I went. When we came to the city, it was about 20 miles, he made the medicine. And he said to me, "I cannot go back with you. You go back yourself. Here's the medicine." That was 20 miles. And that road was, all the houses were burned out. All you see is burned trees, houses. And I was a young girl. I didn't say anything. I didn't say, "Uncle, I wouldn't go." I just went. And I ran because I thought I'll help my brother. By the time I came, I heard my mother crying already. And I knew that he died. Because I walked all the 20 miles. From then on, we already had the idea that we're going to come here, which that was a great hope.
Had you lost contact with your other brothers and sisters and father who had already come here, or did you
no,
still in contact?
No, they were uncles and aunts.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry. Right.
Yeah. No.
Because
what happened?
War, no contact.
No. What? Oh yeah. During the war, there was nothing. No money. Nothing. And that's the way we live like this. We survive. What happened that when we got the visas, we had to go to Warsaw. So we stayed in Warsaw with our aunt in Warsaw. And from there we were going to Danzig. That was the procedure. On the way, at that time, the Poles were fighting the Russians. In the 20s. The trains were full of soldiers, Polish soldiers. On the way to Danzig, they took us off from that train into a little park. We were supposed to wait for another train. And the train that we were, the soldiers took over. But meantime, they stood there near that little park. Among us was an elderly Jew with a white beard with his daughter with their baggage, you know, sitting there. One of the soldiers jumped off from the train, took out his sword, and all the other soldiers formed a line, and each one took out a sword, and they went to that Jew, and everyone needed a chance to do it. So the first one took a little bit piece of the Jew, and he cut it, and the whole line, each one, he gave them a chance. All of them had a chance until the whole beard was gone. So the Jew, that old man, and his daughter fell on their knees, and they were kissing their knees not to do it, but they did it. A Jewish policeman that was in that area, he came over to them and he pleaded with them not to do it. A commandant jumped off the train and ran over to him because he interfered. And he took off everything that he had on him as a policeman, you know. He had it all on. And the man stood there like naked. And this was the anti-Semitism in Poland. When President Reagan were praising so much the Poles, yeah, you can understand how I felt, knowing what was going on there, living there. And so this was one of the incidents. And now, coming to Danzig. So we came to the city.
You had your visas already?
Yeah, in Warsaw.
You got them in Warsaw.
Yeah.
Was it difficult to get the visas?
No.
That was just a formality?
Yeah, but that time everybody was running for America. Yeah.
So these train loads that you're talking about, they were full of people who were making the same journey that you were beginning?
Yeah. Everybody was coming to America, yeah. And we were coming to Danzig. When we came to Danzig, to the city, they told us that we cannot stay there. We were not allowed to stay. They had a rule, and that we have to go to barracks. So they took us to the barracks, because there was a river there, that we had to cross over the river to the barracks. So we stayed at the barracks. And we were only supposed to stay a while there. But, you know, people, when they have money, they can do many things. What they were doing is buying off certain American people, wanted their families to come sooner. They paid off certain people, they went to Danzig, and they had the boats and the families going faster than we could. We stayed there maybe 10 weeks, and the money that my mother had was gone. So my mother had to write for more money. And finally, a little boat came that was going to Rotterdam to take us. That day, and their relatives were staying.
This is the beginning of side two of interview 013.
Yeah, they were on the other side of the river, where they also in barracks. That lady's son was coming with us because he was about to be drafted. So we were going earlier, and so he attached himself to us. He came at the same time with us. That was his mother and his sisters were staying on the other side. So he wanted to see them before we go. So he took me along to the other side. And he stayed there maybe a half hour. But I enjoyed the kids and I wanted to stay longer because our boat was still coming many hours later. So I stayed on and I was with the kids. All of a sudden, when I felt that I ought to go, the policeman in that barrack didn't let me out. All the people went to him, begging him, pleading with him, that my boat is waiting. And he said, she can't go. There was no way to appeal to anybody at all. And no matter how many hundreds of people there were begging him, he said, he wouldn't let me out. The anxiety, the feeling that my family, the boat is there, all that, and he wouldn't let me out. A wagon with hay had to come through. It was a big thing. And I didn't care whether he'll shoot me or whatever will happen. You know, as the wagon was coming in, I ran out. And I had to take a boat, a small boat, to go across that river. So I waited for that little boat and the little boat. But I saw the boat that had to take me. I saw it. It was already making the sounds, you know, like the boat. And I knew the trouble that I'm in. So anyway, I got out from that boat and I started running. And there were police. So they held on to each other like that, not knowing why am I running, you know. I broke through. And my mother and my grandmother and the daughters, they all stood and waited. And they were taking away already the boat was going to leave. But when they saw me running, coming, they put it back. And I got down and they came and they took all the baggage and everything on the boat. So when I got on the boat, I ran downstairs I stayed there all day. I was so embarrassed. That boat that we got on was a very tiny one. And this boat was supposed to get just to go to Rotterdam. And it was a storm for 3 days. From Danzig to Rotterdam was a storm on that sea. And everybody out there went down at the bottom. And most of them were Jewish people. And they put on their talis. And they were laying on the floor and they were praying. Everybody thought that we'll never survive. Every one of them. That this will not, because the boat was laying down this way and that way, you know. The storm was just terrific. But it took 3 days like that. And we came to Rotterdam. We stayed in Rotterdam until we took the Norden. But that's where that picture is, that I met all these people.
That's just before you're about to board. The name of the ship is the Norden?
The Norden.
The Norden.
Yeah. And on the Norden, we traveled, I don't remember how many days, but when we came to Ellis Island, we were not allowed to get off because somebody dies on the boat. So...
On the crossing, someone had died.
Yeah. So this was the procedure then. Something happened, you know. And this is what we were told, that somebody died. That's why we had to be 2 weeks in Ellis Island. And all the families came to pick us up. They had to go back. They couldn't take us off. So that's where we used to form lines, whether it was for food or for some other reasons. And a black man kept on saying, "Get back, get back, get back." That's what I remember, you know. So this is how it worked out. So coming to America, my father was not a big macha. He didn't make, he made about $25 a week. He worked for the brothers that were here before. He came a little later. And so we didn't have much money. So I had to start, instead of going to school, I went to night school. But I had to work. So a cousin of mine had a shop, a dress shop. And he was teaching me how to sew. But he was teaching me wasn't much, not to make like a garment. It was just stitching. And then I had an uncle here that he helped to bring us out here, my mother's brother. And he kept on, he didn't know anything about sewing, but he kept on saying, "You know enough already, you can go into a better place." And I knew that I can, but I couldn't defy him. He arranged for somebody else to take me in. And that was torture. And the boss was very nice. After I had been there, he gave me these beautiful garments that were sold for hundreds of dollars. I didn't know anything about. So the boss came over and he said, "You don't fit. You have to do it in a different place. In this place, it will be difficult for you." So I left it. What I'm trying to say, that I knew that I don't know. Well, there were signs, an operator, and I was supposed to be an operator. So I walked over to that place, and I didn't dare go up. I knew I don't know. So I just walked back, but I knew that I have to work. How do you go up to a place and say, "I am, and I'm not"? And this was really torture to learn, you know. And then finally, somebody told me about a place that she went up with me. And in that factory, there was also only stitching. So I made $75. It was my first week, which was something that never I expected, because it was also only the stitching, you know. From there, he got in very special work. This was just summer work. So he said, you people cannot work this work. So a woman, a Hungarian woman, she was a very slow worker. And she said that I was very fast. So she wanted me as a partner. So we walked the streets. And we went up to a place where it says, operators wanted. So we went up, and we were supposed to be partners. And the work, so she was doing the very fancy work, and I was just doing the other work. In her mind was, so we became union people. We belonged already to the shop. So in her mind was that she's already faster than I am, that I don't know enough. So she said, you know, Rose, I don't want to work partners with you. And I knew I cannot do it on my own, you know. What do I do? So I went over to the employer, and I said, he was a nice man. I said to him, she went over to him, not to give me partner work, you know. So he knew already. So I went over to him and I said, I just want to tell you, on the garment that we both worked, I think that little by little I can make it, if you'll just give me a chance. Because I said, if I can't, I'll leave. I already belong to the union, but the union would not do anything if you don't know how to work. He said, sit down. He gave me a garment. I worked a long time. The other people helped me a little bit. And everybody was very angry for that woman. She did them. I worked in that place about 5 years. On that picture, my mother didn't let me cut my hair. So the way, she only wanted me in braids. I can go to business with braids on. So I used to pick him up like this. And I didn't like it, the way I looked. So I used to argue with my mother to let me. They cut my hair. Finally, a aunt came over and she helped. She talked to my mother, and I ran down and I had my hair cut. When I came to the shop where I worked with my hair cut, instead of the things, the boss called the whole shop over. Look how that girl looks with cut hair. So it looked very nice, good. So I remained there, I think, about 5 years in that shop. And I made a lot of money.
You're
I became fast.
Then. You had learned English.
Yeah, I went to night school. I finished night school. I went to high school for about 2 terms. And then I started up going out with boys, and there was no time for high school.
Let's go back a little bit. I want to hear again about saying, get back.
Get back.
You heard in English, the guy saying, get back.
Get back. Yeah.
This is when you've come off the boat now.
Yeah.
You came into the harbor.
Yeah,
right.
You mean after...
At Ellis Island.
Yeah. And Ellis...
They let you come off the boat right away,
after 2 weeks.
They kept you on the boat?
Oh, not on the boat.
No, okay.
No, the boat was there. We slept on the boat.
They wouldn't let you come onto Ellis Island?
No.
Because someone had died?
But yeah. So this was... that's the way it was.
So your family kept coming to try
they
to
kept,
pick you up?
Yeah. And they knew, and they were here, they were already like Americans,
right.
And they knew what's happening. So this was one situation, many families.
So the family members that came to meet you had already been in this country for 10 years? Yeah. They'd come in 1910?
Yeah.
And you came in 1920?
That's right. Yeah. But another little thing that happened. While we were in the barracks in Danzig, there was a woman that was with us, not related. But she wore a red hat, a high red hat, that when she walked around, everybody noticed her. And she never took off that hat. She put it on in the morning in it because it was a free area. And she had that red hat. So everybody knew that woman with the red hat. We watched her. Her husband came to take her off from Ellis Island. The first thing he did, he took the hat and he threw it. You know, these little things that you remember.
Yeah. I'm a little confused about how long you spent on the boat and how long you were on the island.
I think it was on and off. They let us off the boat. We kept on going on the boat and on the area.
On to Ellis Island.
Yeah.
Did you go through a medical examination at Ellis Island? Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Do you remember coming into the building and walking up the staircase?
I don't remember every little thing, but this was this.
Yeah.
We had to go through all that.
Uh-huh.
And
do you remember anything about the building?
Little.
Not so much. Yeah. Where would you eat? Would they feed you on the boat?
They fed us on the boat.
On the boat.
Yeah. The whole thing took place the way it was. Yeah. But we were free to go off, not back.
You were free to come off and
on
the island on the boat.
Yeah. All we knew that we cannot get off. The family cannot take us.
You couldn't leave the island.
No. And the reason, they told us the reason, that somebody died, and they didn't know what it was.
So do you remember what you would have done for those 2 weeks? Would you have spent time, you were free to wander around the island?
That's right.
But you don't remember so much about what
no.
the building
was. And the families, they were not allowed, I think, to come there. The families came and
you couldn't talk to them?
No.
Did you see them? Could you see them
outside,
over the boat
and
wave?
That's right. That's
so,
right.
So you knew that
they're there.
Someone would be there to pick you up.
Yeah, a lot of the families,
talk.
Yeah. And then when we came here, we had so many relatives that I said to my mother, we can make a little city out of all the families that came to see us. And I just want to say, my father took me to a cousin that they were wealthy people. So she wanted to see me. So he took me there. So she had a feeling that she has to buy me something. So she took me into a place where they had the push carts with shoes. And she picked up a pair of shoes. Did you see what I wore? The shoes that she picked up for me were the points with buttons all the way up there. And I couldn't say no. The things that you go through when you're a greenhorn, and you come in, they're relatives, but at the same time, they were here, and they were ready. They didn't go through what we went through. And you don't say no to anybody. You accept all that they do to you. And they look down at you, although they were greenhorns themselves, but they look down on you, that you are just coming out. You're a greenhorn. What do you know? You know nothing.
Do you remember them coming to pick you up on the day you were released from Ellis Island? Do you remember how you got to their house?
What happened is an uncle, but I have him here on the picture. He sold his beautiful house that we knew about, and he moved in Houston Street to a railroad apartment. So for a while, we had to stay with him. you know, the feeling where I was born, living on the estate, knowing a little bit of nicer things, you know. And America stood out like the golden house in the country. And all of a sudden he takes us in. Such a dilapidated place. So the whole vision of America. So what is this? Is this America?
What had been your vision?
Huh?
What did you expect you would find? What did you think America would be like?
I felt like the whole world will open up for me. You know, I felt I'll go to school, I'll become something. That's the expectation, that you went through all that horrible stuff. When you come here, America stood out like something very beautiful. And then all of a sudden, you find that it isn't. Like we lived on the... My father got an apartment on the fifth floor. And we lived there. And Lanceman, that came from the city that we knew, they carried ice on their back up on the fifth floor. They carried coal on the back. It was a hot time there at that time. Now it's different. Now there is relief, there's all kinds of things. That time there was nothing like that. So it was a hard time.
You were surrounded by a lot of people
from relatives,
people from, you knew.
Yeah, as I
Did
say, almost like I said.
The same,
yeah.
Settled
some
the
of them were rich by the time we came, and some of them were not. So when I saw those landsmen coming up on the fifth floor with bags of ice, bags of coal, it was doing something to me. I said, it's not so nice, but what I thought it would be.
How about when you were first coming into the harbor, when you were first coming in on the boat, and you didn't know you were going to have the trouble? Can you remember what that was like? And how you felt when you...
A great disappointment. But there was no way, like people would say that it's like to go back. There was no place to go back.
Right.
There was no way. So you had to take whatever it was.
Were you afraid that you would be rejected when you came through? Did you have that fear that the boat you might have to go back on the boat?
No.
When you couldn't come through?
No. There was no fear. It was just a situation.
Just a matter of time.
But there was no fear at all.
Did you see other boatloads come in and go through Ellis Island? Did you see other people approach?
Yeah, other boats. Yeah. You know, the disappointment came after we landed. Not in Ellis Island. When things were happening here. So that's what disappointment. And as a young person with expectations, you feel it. And my first problem was that I couldn't go to school. I went
to high school. Because
you had to work? I had to work.
So started to go to night school?
I went to night school. In night school, you meet young people like came over. So you make a lot of friends. So that's interesting. But when I made the decision not to go to high school, I mean, quit high school, I was sorry for a long time that I didn't.
So you pretty much started working right away then?
That's right, right away.
So no time for school, but night school, that must have been a very difficult period.
Yeah.
Working
studying
at night.
That's right.
Did you pick up the language quickly?
In a way, yeah. I remember that my employer, not immediately, but after a few years, put in my name that I had to pay tax. I didn't know what it's all about. That's fine. So I was called to the tax bureau. When I told them, I was making money that time, you know, why I didn't pay before. My father was killed. My father was killed. He went to shul and he was killed. So I became the sole support of the family. So another thing that hit me. When I look back, I'm thinking why my mother was only about 38, 40 when she came. Why didn't she go to work? I don't know. She never worked. But she could have.
She could have.
She could have. But she didn't.
So you took over.
I took over all the years. And over here too, I had a wonderful husband. He was a Jewish writer. I went to school and I became a sculptress. And I made these things. I worked with jewelry. I picked up so many things. But something was wrong. I didn't stick to one thing. So I didn't get the way I wanted to get. That was a hindrance. I don't know the reasons. I should have gone to a psychiatrist.
You met your husband in this country then?
Yes.
Yeah. When was that? At what point in your life was that?
I think it was in 32. Yeah. Oh, I didn't tell you. It's something important. When I became the supporter of the family, I was very unhappy. I also went through a very serious love affair that I thought I'll die if I don't marry that guy. And he was supposed to study for a doctor. And his parents were supporting, his father was supporting him. And they said that if he'll marry me, they will not support him and he wouldn't be able to go to school. So that was a break. I suffered terribly. So a girlfriend of mine and I decided to hitchhike to California. So we did. And we were 4 months on the road. I saw America, but three-quarters of America. Every national park I was. Everywhere. Just certain places we omitted. Otherwise, 4 months. And that was a very interesting, beautiful time. And
did people do that a lot then? They would hitchhike? Travel at that time?
At that time. Now would be... If she would go hitchhiking now, I would die. What's happening now,
right.
You know? But that time, a lot of people went.
Yeah.
And being 4 months on the road, at that time, the sales people didn't fly like they do now. They traveled with cars, and they were so eager to take you in their car to travel with you. And we went from one place to another, which was points of interest. So we kept on going and going. And I stayed in Yellowstone Park. We stayed there in Yellowstone Park and in Glacier Park and in Mount Rainier. And while I was in California, I was there 2 years.
Oh.
I saw a lot. I slept in Grand Canyon. And I did a lot of...
Were you tempted to stay in any particular places along this journey? Were you thinking
we
of
stayed,
moving?
No, we stayed in areas that we looked wide over the sea. That we felt was okay. Mm-hmm. But in Grand Canyon, we slept there because the men that took care of the animals told us that we came in too late. It would be at nightfall. So he let us stay in his place. He gave us dinner. It was nice. Now I hear it's different, but that time also different.
And did you say you lived in California then for a while?
2 years.
2 years.
And I worked there. And I send my mother money to support her. But I liked it there.
You went,
You
hitchhiked out to California and then you stayed there for 2 years.
Right. Yeah. And I worked there. I got a job. And I worked. And whatever I earned, I didn't need much for myself. Because there was a life. You don't have to dress or go to theaters or concerts. You know, you just go to the canyons. So that was okay.
But then you came back to New York.
Then I came back to New York. I have a sister that is mentally sick. And this is why I had to come back. My mother wanted me to come back. But my sister is still sick. And I am her guardian. I take care of her. And she lives in the Bronx. And she doesn't want to move out from that area where she and my mother used to live. So that's the worst thing in my life. Somehow also my mother didn't let her see a doctor. There's something, a fear to be alone or something like that. That's how it remains. That's the saddest story of my life.
Do you have any of the letters? Do you remember when you were still living in Poland and some of your family had come here? Do you have any of the letters that they sent to you? Or could you tell me anything about what you had heard about what America might be like through them?
You mean the time where we were... When we were in Europe,
Yes, when you were there, and they
and
were
the family.
Here.
Yeah. My grandfather, he taught of America too, that all his sons that are here became millionaires, but they didn't. One son had a pushcart fruit. Another son was working on hats, and they were all. Not wealthy, but he kept on asking them for money. So one of my uncles wrote him a letter, and he said to him, in America, they don't, what do you call a thing that you need, a broom, let's say. That you don't, with a broom, you don't, gold is not there on the streets, that you do it with a broom, you pick it up. So that was the answer to my grandfather. And because to think of America, some of them came and they went back. Some relatives that didn't want to stay here. So people knew that it's nice. And that's nice in America.
But you, did you think of it as a place where you wouldn't be persecuted as a... This is Nancy DeLette. Today is August 6, 1985. And this is interview number 013. It's the second tape of that. We're interviewing Mrs. Kravitz. This is the beginning of what would be the third side of the interview.
No, I'd asked you about if you got letters. What were we just talking about?
Well,
I changed the subject.
No, whether we got letters in Europe.
Oh, yeah. And have you thought of
So some letters came. Some,
oh, I know.
Some people came.
Yeah, that's once you got to this country, did you feel that anti-Semitism was behind you? Or did
that's
you,
right.
You didn't really experience it in this country in any sense?
No. In the shop you did.
Pardon?
In the shop.
In the shop?
Yeah.
You did experience it or you didn't?
Yes.
You did?
Sure.
Yeah. In what form? How did that happen?
There was a, I worked in a shop, and there was an Italian woman. She was a full lady, and she used to talk about it. And so I used to fight her. Used to fight her by the Jews. She was anti-Semite.
That must have been very hard for you to encounter.
Somehow I took it in stride. Somehow, like, I'm used to it, you know, and it's not supposed to happen here.
Right.
So I fought back. I worked in a place where there was a woman that her father, she was Italian, and her father was, she went for a visit, and her father worked for Mussolini. And she came back, and in the shop, she stood in the middle of the shop, and she told all about Mussolini, the great things, you know. And the people from the shop workers, they stood and they listened, you know. And I felt that I isn't right, you know. So I told her, your father works for Mussolini, so he gets all the goodies. In Sicily, you know, the areas, they're poor, they're starving. You didn't see that. You just went for a visit. And your father provided you with all the beautiful things. I said, don't tell me that this is what's going on for everybody in Italy under Mussolini. So I had to put it down. I fight back. If somebody on the radio talked about Poland, all the beautiful things that's going on in Poland, and not a mention of anything that was bad. So I called up while they were talking. I called up and I said, it's not so. There's a lot of anti-Semitism. And, you know, when Reagan was speaking about what's going on there, that's a wonderful old. I said, it's not so.
A few other things I wanted to ask you. I'm not sure how you responded to this when I asked whether you had any letters now, whether you still have, or any of the documents, any passport, visa, or anything with a stamp that says you came through, any of the ports, any kind of documentation like that. The people at Ellis Island are very interested in preserving that kind of thing.
I have all these things.
What
Is
kind
that
of,
what you're asking?
Yeah. What kind of things do you have? You showed me the one photograph.
No.
Just before you were about to go.
I have everything. Many things.
Documents?
Yeah.
Photographs? Passport? Okay.
I have it from my mother, my brother, my sister, everybody. Mine.
Okay. Can you tell me, just one more question really, can you tell me, anything that happened on the boat or any feelings you might have had when you came into the harbor? Remember seeing the Statue of Liberty and coming into Ellis Island?
That was so exciting. We finally reached America. It was a terrific thing. But all that we went through, such a period, the wars, everything was going on there, anti-Semitism. And finally we are in America. It was just... The other part, disappointments came in later.
Okay.
But the arrival, even the disappointment of the 2 weeks, it was not, we didn't take it bad. So we accepted it. That's the way it is. But
Did you know that the Statue of Liberty was there? Were you expecting to see it? Had you heard about it in Poland, or was it a sight that surprised
you? No, we didn't know.
You?
It's a surprise. It was beautiful. And the poem, you know, that we always have, just terrific. The Statue of Liberty goes in with this museum. It's combined, or is it?
Yes, it's a combined reservation for both the Statue of Liberty and Ellis Island.
That's beautiful. There were so many prospects, different things, disappointment things, where they taught us. I heard, and when I heard about the museum,
just for immigration, yeah.
Just beautiful.
Yeah. Have you returned to Ellis Island since?
Since I was there.
Came through? Did you ever take a trip out?
Sure. That's what I heard. Somebody interviewed me there.
Someone interviewed you? And you went out with
I went with
your
my
daughter.
Daughter.
Yeah. And did you tell her what happened as you came through? Did you remember it as you came through?
I didn't tell too much with the person that interviewed me, you know, but I told her about, get back, get back. That's my first English words.
Yeah. But there wasn't anything about the island at that point when you saw it that sparked off memories of what it was like when you came through. You
know? All that expectation that you finally came to America. So what's 2 weeks? Nothing.
Right.
You know, you finally are here. And that's, as far as I was concerned, you know, I expected so much to make of myself that I thought that here is the place. Because I was in Europe, they didn't let Jews go to school. You had to do it on your own. And my father used to send not much money. But my mother paid teachers, and I was a good student. And my brother that died too was a very good student. And I had teachers that they went to America also. And so that was a struggle. The idea there that a Jew cannot go to school where we were, only the gents. So I had girlfriends. They went to school, I couldn't go.
Did you, once you were here and you were established here in New York, did other relatives who hadn't come on your journey come later? Did you continue?
I know what you're asking, yeah. I have a picture here of my aunt that she wrote to my mother that she had a daughter. And the daughter, her husband, or daughter and her husband, that they would like, they were very poor, that they would like to come to America, if there were any possibility. So my uncle was rich, my mother's brother, and my mother went to him and asked him that he could bring him out. So his wife said, don't bother. And Isla killed him. Things that happened. Isla killed our families, about 150 families that he killed. In one city where we lived a couple of years, the Germans put up the peasants around, lived around the city. And the Germans didn't like the peasants. And they told the peasants, you can go to the city and do for the Jews whatever you want. So they thought that they'll ingratiate themselves with the Germans if they'll do it instead of the Germans. So they killed the whole city. There's nothing there.
So after you had come, it was really too late for others to follow behind you.
That's right. There was also a time that in the United States that they didn't let people come in. Immigration stopped. And then they opened up again. The Eurasian areas where they come.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, after 1924, that changed.
Yeah.
I think that's all I need to ask, unless there's anything else you want to add to this.
what happened on in Rotterdam, mm-hmm. that I have a picture on that picture that you saw. Mm-hmm. So there was one young man that liked me, and we made up. And we made up, but when we come here, because they went on a different boat, and I went on a different boat. That's my, so there was my, yeah. Mm-hmm. He was a very nice kid, and so they gave me. They had the telephone. They had the address where we lived, so they wrote to me. He had a brother there and a sister, and they wanted me to come visit with him. And I remember this uncle of mine picked me up because I couldn't reach the telephone. And I talked on the phone. I made up that I will go to visit them. They lived in the Bronx. So when I visited them, I went into one of the rooms. There was a mirror. And I fixed my hair. So he got in, this fella, in my first kiss.
So he had come on a different ship. Not
yeah.
Anyone in this picture
no.
Came on the Norton.
No.
Right. Anyone else that you're...
This was this
still
fella...
around that you're in touch with? Anyone you still
over
know?
Here. Mm-hmm. This was a cousin.
Uh-huh.
That he came with us. And these people we met in Rotterdam.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But I wasn't in touch with any, but only that family. When he came here, he organized a club, and he became the president. And I was his girlfriend, so it was a nice experience.
That's wonderful. Okay, I think that's it. I'll just want you to maybe talk to me a bit about some of the documents that you
that's
have.
Right.
But that concludes the interview, 013, and it's 12:50.